Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast, where we explore the science of being human in a very human way. There is laughter, there is fun, there are interruptions by pet dogs. There's lots of curious questions, and there is always a goal of helping you to be the best human that you can be. And today we're getting curious about emotions and the brain, in part because it's been a topic that I've been exploring with our community members, and in part because as I learn more about the brain, and I am by no means an expert, I'm discovering that much of what we know or certainly read and hear about the brain just isn't at the forefront of the science. There seems to be a lag between what the neuroscientists and other experts know and what we hear in the everyday media sometimes, on YouTube, in podcasts, by speakers, by consultants, and sometimes by other coaches. And that means that we, as curious learners, are not always being fed the most up-to-date information. So, in the interest of keeping you, our lovely, smart, lifelong learners, right at the cutting edge, we're exploring the neuroscience of emotions today with Dr. Sarah Mackay and perhaps busting a few myths. And one of the things I love about today's conversation and many of the conversations that we have here on the show is that we start out talking about one topic, in this case, emotions in the brain, and we end up talking about something entirely different, like science education and how a global pandemic might just be the perfect opportunity to discuss the scientific method in schools. But I'll let you listen in to that wonderful explorative discussion in a moment. Before I do, I want to acknowledge that this month, October, is Mental Health Month, which means, of course, that you will hear much discussion about mental ill health, depression, anxiety, symptoms, treatments, risk, and the like. And as I've said on the show before, that's all important stuff. It's vital stuff. But we do like to do things a little differently here at Potential Psychology. We like to focus on mental health when we're talking about mental health, not mental ill health. And this month, we are talking on our social platforms and in our membership program and pretty much at every opportunity I can about how having a sense of purpose in your life, feeling like you are contributing to something greater than yourself, connecting with and serving other people and perhaps causes and communities, contributes to positive mental health and resilience and engagement and a sense of well-being and life satisfaction. It is happening over on our social media feeds. You can choose your poison. We're on all of them, except Twitter. I still can't get Twitter to work with my brain. And I'm sharing tips and stories and facts and tools for uncovering your purpose and talking a little about how some COVID reflection has prompted me to refine my sense of purpose and who I serve. And that's leading to some reshaping of Potential Psychology's focus. But don't worry, nothing's changing for the podcast. We're continuing with our conversations about the science of human flourishing. So why don't we do exactly that? And find out a little bit more about today's guest and our discussion of emotions and the brain. I am thrilled to have with me today Dr. Sarah Mackay, an Australian-based, Kiwi-born and bred neuroscientist, speaker, author, media personality, and founder and director of Think Brain and the Neuroscience Academy suite of training programs. Sarah has been a guest on the show before when we spoke about her book, The Women's Brain Book, The Neuroscience of Health, Hormones and Happiness, and busted some myths about things like baby brain and PMS. Today, Sarah is joining me to help answer some questions that have cropped up for me recently when doing doing some work with my self-care club on emotions. It seems there's a lot of confusion out there regarding the structures of the brain and the role that they play in our experience of emotions. Talk of lizards and prehistoric structures that lie deep within our brain and emotional hijacking. And I found myself getting a bit confused about how this all works within the brain and how much we should believe it. So as is my wont, I'm turning to an expert who will help us tease all of this out and get a better understanding of how our brain works when it comes to how we feel. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to be back.
I am very pleased to have you here. It is always lovely to have a chat with you, both on the air and off the air. And I know you've got a lot of cool stuff that you will be able to share with our audience today. And I wanted to start with a blog post that you wrote a few months ago. Entitled Rethinking the Reptilian Brain.
Yes.
Which is a great title in itself, because automatically when you think of a reptilian brain, you're thinking of something kind of scaly and hard and not perhaps akin to a human brain. But why write the blog post for starters?
Look, the discussions around the reptilian brain or the lizard brain, or sometimes people might have heard of the triune brain, have been cropping up more and more and more in discussions I've had with various people interested in all things brain in the last sort of 5-10 years, particularly since I've started teaching neuroscience to the helping professionals, as I call them, the kind of world of coaches, therapists, psychologists like yourself. Now, I am kind of a don't want to use the word old-fashioned neuroscientist, but I'm a neuroscientist who trained in neuroscience all through university, my undergraduate, my master's, my PhD, postdoc trainings in neuroscience. And this concept, the lizard brain, the reptilian brain, wasn't anything that I'd ever really heard of. And I was kind of confused to see that it would come up and up and time and time again in so many of the conversations that I was having with people from outside, I suppose, of the neuroscience academic world. And people would ask me kind of where it is, or what is it, or how does it relate to emotions, or how does it relate to the subconscious brain? And so I guess I sort of started noticing conversations in which it was taking place. And I suppose from the perspective of neuroscience, one of the things that, and one, irritated me, and two, kind of intrigued me at the same time, was how often it was used as a bit of a default to describe almost any thought or feeling or behavior that was almost automatic. And then I started noticing it pop up, and I'd notice it in a book, or I would notice it in a conference poster, or I would notice it in a discussion in a blog post. And it was always maybe even a TED Talk.
Yeah, I think Seth Godin has,
Godin talks about it a lot. It comes up in marketing conversations. I teach an awful lot of coaches. Every coach would be talking about it. And then I noticed that if you looked at the brain anatomy in which they were referring to, everyone was kind of talking about a different part of the brain when they were referring to it. And I was like, that people seemed to be using it not as a kind of a metaphor or as a sort of a shorthand descriptor of automated behaviors or automated emotions. Rather, it was an actual part of the brain. And I would see these sort of diagrams of the brain pointing to the reptilian brain, but it was always pointing to a different part of the brain. So I was like, I've got to get on top of this. People were always talking to me about it. People were always asking me about it. And I'd been kind of dismissing it for a number of years. And then, much to my absolute delight, earlier this year, a paper was published, and it had the most glorious title that I've almost ever read in academia. It said, "Your brain is not an onion with a tiny reptile inside." And essentially, it was published in Current Directions in Psychological Sciences. So it's kind of an opinion piece written by some researchers who work in evolutionary biology, essentially pulling apart this idea, saying that it's widely used in most conversations outside of neuroscience and outside of evolutionary biology. And I guess the idea of their paper was, it's completely inaccurate. It's a mistaken view of the brain. Neuroscientists and evolutionary biologists are in unanimous agreement that it's baseless. And so let's sort of stop using it. And I was like, hooray, there's another academic paper out there dismissing this idea.
And one of the few academic papers that actually has an interesting title. They're not known for their catchy titles.
No. So, and I thought, well, if I'm going to write you know, I'd love to write more about this as a kind of a reference almost. Whenever anyone's talking about this, I'm going, look, here's why this idea is baseless. I thought, well, I can't really write about that unless I'm giving people an alternative language or story or concept in which to work with. So I spent a bit of time kind of researching and writing and thinking about this, and that was how the blog post came about. But I wanted to basically not myth bust, but point out where the science currently lies, where the thinking's gone wrong, how it came about, and what we can do and what we can talk about instead. Because I think it's all very well to myth bust or to say that's inaccurate or don't say that or that's baseless, but we've got to give people some alternatives instead. So really the blog post is also an exploration of what people are using this descriptive for. And if anyone goes away and reads the blog post, there's quite a lot of comments. Some people have really taken quite offence to this piece that I've written. But anyway.
Well, that's probably a sign that it's important in some way, isn't it? Yeah. That it's actually, you know, created some emotion.
Yes, for sure. It's triggered the lizard brain, that's for sure.
So where did the lizard brain come from? I mean, I've read the blog post, and what was interesting for me, and I think what helped me, because I come from a behavioral point of view, being a psychologist, so I didn't necessarily have the understanding of the brain. But what I did find really difficult from what I've heard about discussions of this lizard brain or this kind of automatic triggered thing that sits somewhere and leads to these uncontrolled automatic behaviours was that I couldn't find, I was really confused about where this bit of the brain was supposed to be. You know, was it the amygdala? Was it something else? And so that was difficult. So your blog post certainly was informative for me on that post, but I'm interested for our listeners, you know, where did the term come from? Where did this all start, do you think?
Yeah, so it was proposed by a neuroscientist actually, but back in the 1960s, in fact, it was a neuroscientist called Paul McLean, who's no longer Earthside, but he did do an awful lot of important work, but he also had some quite old-fashioned beliefs, and it has been reported that he did also believe in, he was a believer in phrenology, so you can kind of tell someone's personality or protect their behaviours by sort of the shape of their skull and
the bumps on the head,
their eyes and things like that. So, and let's be fair, he was obviously formulating this idea back in the late 1950s. So it was a really, really long time ago. He proposed this idea that there is a triune brain that kind of emerged in human brains, that the human brain's kind of divided into these three layers, and each of these layers have grown on top of one another, and they've emerged in succession during evolution. And the oldest, and he proposed as the reptilian part of the brain, controls basic functions like breathing and body temperature and heart rate. And so we might say that this would be parts of the brain such as the brain stem and maybe the hypothalamus, because that's what they do. And then he said the next part of the brain to develop in evolution, kind of grow on top of that reptilian brain, was the limbic brain, which might include, variously, depending on which book you read, and I think that we need to use the word limbic system or limbic brain reasonably loosely. It's not a specifically defined area, but it typically involves regions like the amygdala and the hippocampus and some other regions of cortex. And then the third kind of part of the brain that grew on top of that was the cerebral cortex, which controls things like language and reason. Now, there's all kinds of ways in which this falls apart from an evolutionary perspective, and they do talk about this in great detail in the Your Brain Is Not an Onion with a Tiny Reptile Inside, and that is not how human brains evolved. It kind of implies that evolution is this sort of linear progression from lizards to mice to monkeys to humans, which it's not. We kind of all fanned out. We didn't evolve from lizards. Actually, humans and lizards evolved in different branches of the tree of evolution, but we did evolve from a common ancestor. There's various other evolutionary notions in which that falls down. McLean proposed this back in the 1960s, and the problem that's really kind of come from that is, I suppose, is a lack of clear understanding about brain anatomy, and that's absolutely fine. We don't expect people to understand about brain anatomy, but it's been the reptilian brain has then been used to describe and label almost every structure in the brain, apart from those that he originally proposed, and it's been used almost in partnership or almost hand in hand with this idea of kind of fight or flight responses, which we can talk about in a bit, because I've actually got some questions for you based on the psychology around that. Now, one of the reasons why I suppose this triple layer idea of brain evolution and human brain development, it's kind of catchy because everyone loves a neuroscience explanation. We call this the seductive allure of the neuroscience explanation. If it sounds neuroscience-y, people aren't typically going to question it. But it also kind of appeals because it seems to give a bit of biological plausibility to, for example, Freud's theories of personalities. You've got the id and the ego and the superego, which might map neatly onto these different parts of the brain. So it appears intuitively to be correct. It sounds science-y. The problem is it's now used in this kind of catch-all kind of terminology. The problem is that we now understand a whole lot more about brain evolution, a whole lot more about brain development than back in the 1960s when he published this. And it's basically now we know that there's really little base for it, but because it feels right, people still use it.
And I wonder too whether there is almost an element of I don't have to take ownership for part of what I do.
Oh, for sure.
Because this is my lizard brain. You know, it's a nice, simple, almost, it's out of my control. Therefore, I don't need to take responsibility for what's happening. And I think, too, you made a really good point before about, you know, when you're writing this in your blog post that we need alternative language. I think this, you know, it's a simple concept. They're simple words. They're ways that we can really make a very complex thing, being the brain and its structures and the evolution and all of that and all of those ideas into nice, you know, humans like to simplify things, make them easy.
Sure.
We're essentially kind of lazy aren't we?
For sure. And I think if we are going to simplify them and make them easy and make them understandable, then we need to make the foundation of that, the science of that, correct. And I suppose for me that this is the problem. And I guess what your point that it almost absolves you of any behaviours. For me, the impression it also gives, this kind of little cold reptilian brain that sort of, this part of you that sort of sits inside at the core of everything, that's sort of scared and twitchy and is waiting for something to go wrong. And all of our responses are kind of then primarily based on fear and this kind of automated feeling inside us that we can't do anything about. And in a way, like you say, it absolves you of responsibility. It also removes any sense of agency that you do have, not only over your thoughts and your behaviours, but also your emotions. And that's where the kind of the current neuroscience understanding is. And I imagine also psychology, you could probably correct me or not there, that we do have agency over many of our responses. And if we're constantly talking about this lizard brain, the implication is, well, no, we don't. And that almost all of our subconscious or unconscious decision-making is driven by fear. Whereas a lot of, you know, the reasons we think, feel and behave are driven by a whole host of different other motivators, habits, perhaps desires, perhaps, you know, reward seeking. It's not all automated fear responses. And I feel in a way that that then becomes quite a damaging message that we're continually throwing out there, that that's the kind of the default that is at the core of who you are. And so you can't really do much about it. And I think that that really, in a way, is quite a damaging message. And I guess my question would be is, if you're a psychologist and you're working with a patient or a client, is that the message that you would be giving them? If you're, and I suppose the next sort of step in my thought process around this, and perhaps as a question to pose to you as a psychologist, is there are regions of the brain that respond to perhaps external events, process them, the amygdala being one part of that processing network that then does trigger your autonomic nervous system, which includes your sympathetic nervous system and your parasympathetic nervous system, to trigger a set of physiological responses in your body. Now, when we talk about the sympathetic nervous system, again, the language we always use is fight or flight, which again implies fear-driven. I'm trying to think perhaps it could be you are just rising to the opportunity or rising to the challenge. Your body is going to respond in the same way, but the language we're using is fear-based. So I'm really concerned that we are then almost telling people that that response is to do with fear, not to do with perhaps just your body getting ready to respond to an opportunity, perhaps getting ready to talk to someone on the phone, or perhaps you're just getting ready to go for a jog outside. Your heart rate's going to go up in advance of doing that. So, yeah, I'm curious about that.
Well, two things. I mean, firstly, there is an excellent, and you've probably seen it, TED Talk by Kelly McGonigal, who's a health psychologist, about rethinking stress. And one of her themes in there that I really love was, you know, if we can think about stress not as something that's going to do us harm, so all of those physiological reactions and that kind of fear that comes from that, which is part of what anxiety is. One of the reasons why panic is such a problem for people is because we get panicked about feeling panic. So if we can start to reframe some of those physiological experiences less as, oh my God, this is stress, this is bad, this is discomfort, I need to get away from it, I need to avoid it, repress it, self-medicate to do something to get rid of the feelings, whatever it might be. And if we can reframe it as, this is just a signal that my body is getting ready to do something that it needs to do in this moment. And that could be perform, whether that's an athletic feat, a performance feat, public speaking, having a difficult conversation, whatever it might be. And then as soon as we're able to reframe it that way, we start to get a better handle on the feelings. We become less likely to try and avoid, suppress, get distressed as a result of the physiological response. And this is something that I have actually been talking to people a lot about this year because of the unprecedented stress that so many people have been experiencing. And very much that point, as you say, that it helps to understand what your brain's doing to trigger some of the physiological experience. You know, why is it I'm having trouble sleeping? Why is it my brain is going at 100 miles an hour? Why is it that my shoulders are up around my ears and my tummy's funny and all of that sort of stuff? But again, you know, the conversation has to be, and I think, well, I would hope that all psychologists would be saying, this is a sign that something's going on. It's up to you now to work out how to interpret those signs and signals and what it is you're going to do about it to attain your goals, keep well, function at your best. We have those automatic physical responses that are generated from what happens in your brain, but then that extra layer of complex system that is a human being then starts to trigger all of those thoughts about, this is bad, this is wrong, I don't like this, I can't cope, all of those pieces. And that's what psychologists do, it's to help to educate and guide people through understanding that process. And the brain is just a piece of it. So I absolutely agree that just this idea that, you know, telling people that you've got this bit of lizard brain that's out of your control. Yeah.
The lizard brain makes the fear.
And it's going to take over.
Fight and flight, exactly. And then that is almost, if we say we've got a lizard brain and it's responsible for the fight or flight response, then that is then the meaning we make of perhaps any instance of raised heart rate or perhaps nervous tummy, et cetera, you know, instead of, and as I talk about in the blog post, we talk about the ingredients of emotion. So some of the work that I've started to try and pull from is work by a couple of different neuroscientists in this space who talk about the neurobiology of emotions, and this is kind of their life's work. So one people may have heard of, Lisa Feldman Barrett, who's written a fantastic book around the emotional brain and this idea that there are ingredients which sort of feed in or coalesce to make up our conscious experience of an emotion. And some of them are the physiological sensations we feel in our body, whatever they may be, based on the situation we're in, the context we're in, also the people that we're with. And that all coalesces up with our memories, our personal experiences, how perhaps we've been taught to interpret what's going on, and once again, that language. Because we're humans, we've got this extra ingredient that most animals don't, which is the ability to name or use words to describe what's happening inside ourselves. So we've got that language that we've learned to describe this, and all of this kind of coalesces together to give you this conscious experience of some type of feeling slash emotion. So Lisa Feldman Barrett's been working in this space, and there's another scientist, Joseph Ledoux, who has also proposed a very, very similar theory that, you know, we do have, yes, we have these physiological responses that are triggered as part of our autonomic nervous system response to whatever's happening out there or inside our own mind. But that's not the only ingredient. The other ingredients also include memories, experiences, language, you know, the stories that we've been told as we're growing up about what's going on when we feel something. And so that's kind of, I think, a more useful way to be talking about emotions you know, the meaning we make about bodily sensations versus this lizard brain triggers a fight or flight response. It's all fear-based. And that's, I guess, people want to go away and read more about it, is where I kind of take that discussion, that this is what we need to be talking about. This is a much more empowering way to discuss what's happening in our brain. It's a much more neuroscientifically accurate way. It's much more up-to-date. And most importantly, it gives people a sense of agency and understanding over, well, the physiological sensations are just one ingredient. What meaning am I making of them based on, you know, what they're learning from their psychologist, perhaps the words that they can use to describe that experience. And then the really wonderful thing about that is then going forward, what's your conscious experience of that emotion going to be in the future? Maybe it's going to be something far more positive and different and empowering, like you say.
Mm. That theory of constructed emotion, that kind of, you know, the coalescing of all of these different factors in the moment and our interpretation of what's going on, brings to mind this question, and this will be an interesting one to get your take on, of what is the difference, if there is, from a neuroscientific point of view or in your mind, between an emotion and a feeling? How do you differentiate between the two?
I, of late, have stopped differentiating between the two. So in one of my neuroscience textbooks does differentiate between the two of them, between emotions and feelings. And I believe in this, Kandel, Jessel and Schwartz, one of the kind of the principles of neuroscience, kind of Bibles of neuroscience. And in that they differentiate between emotions and feelings. And they use the word emotions to describe all of the, let's use the word subconscious or unconscious processing that is happening in terms of responding to a situation or a threat, whether that be in the real world or inside our own mind, and the physiological responses that take place. A feeling, they say, is your conscious awareness of that emotion. So in a way, we could say the feeling is the kind of cake, let's use that word, cake, versus the emotions are perhaps one of the ingredients. So they differentiate it that way. But I have kind of come around to the way of thinking that we, in common day, at least English speakers, we use those two words kind of interchangeably, emotions and feelings. And I think that it's really important when we're trying to explain neuroscience and use neuroscience to kind of understand ourselves, that we kind of also pay credence to how we describe these things happening. You know, the language that we use, and we tend to use emotions and feelings interchangeably a lot of the time anyway. Most people do. So I've kind of moved away from trying to differentiate them on a neuroscientific basis and using some of the language. So Joseph Ledoux talks a lot about this, kind of the conscious experience of the emotion versus the subconscious processing of the emotion. He uses those two words interchangeably. And so it really kind of depends perhaps on which textbook you've picked up and read, or how you maybe decide is a useful way to explain that to a particular person, because you might have someone that might see them as separate, and so you could say, well, let's use emotions to talk about the brain networks and the body networks involved with that and the feeling as the conscious experience of that emotion. Someone else may use them interchangeably, so that language differentiation might not work. That's the approach I would take.
Mm. That kind of idea, that perhaps older now, idea of emotions being the physiological response, those things that are emergent properties of the brain in terms of what's going on in the system, and then feelings being your interpretation of that and kind of the how your body feels in response. So we'd use in psychological terms, you know, words like distress and positive, which even that, I mean, language is so tricky, isn't it? Because one of the words we often use when we're talking about feelings and emotions is positive and negative. And yet, again, you could certainly argue, and I do, that there's not necessarily positive or negative, you know, in terms of our experience and what we can use these signals for. They're both or either. So language does make it tricky. But I think I'm wondering whether, as you were talking about this modern thinking around emotions and where they come from and how they're created, whether that's actually reducing those two, you know, the two become one almost in one way. Because if we're thinking about emotion being something that emerges from our interpretation, the stimuli, the experience, the language, the people around us, all of that, there has to be an element of interpretation in there.
Yeah, we're using these words in quite a colloquial way as well. and different people from different parts of the world. I've got people from all over the world come and do my courses, and a lot of them don't speak English as a first language. And so that's why I kind of started moving away from that, because people tend to use them interchangeably, and to try and say emotions are this and feelings are that doesn't really work in terms of understanding what's actually going on. So I've tended to move away from it and now just sort of use the word emotions, I suppose, and talk about what are the various ingredients of our conscious emotional experience.
Mm, I love those terms. Can you repeat those again, the ones that he uses? Because I think that really worked in my brain for what the two are.
He talks about sort of threat response systems, which again, I sort of almost have a problem with, because that implies to people if your sympathetic nervous system is activated is because of a threat. But the example I give in the blog is, well, you might have a lion chasing an antelope. Both of the physiological response of both those animals is probably pretty identical, but the lion's probably not scared. The lion's probably not feeling fear. It's probably going, woohoo, I'm hungry and there's a great opportunity. Right. They're probably feeling quite excited and pumped and up for the chase, whereas you pretty much guarantee the antelope's feeling fear. So again, they've got these different ingredients kind of giving rise to that subconscious experience. So Joseph Ledoux would talk about threat response systems, whereas again, I almost have a bit of a problem with that word threat, because the lion's probably not under threat. The lion's responding to an opportunity.
Actually, that's a great example, isn't it? Those two things, because inwardly, you know, physiologically and neuroscientifically, from the sounds of things, the same stuff is going on for those two creatures in that moment. And yet,
for sure,
certainly as an outsider looking at that situation, we would say, oh, well, the antelope's feeling this and the lion's feeling that, and they're both quite different things. Now, we don't actually know.
For sure we don't, because they haven't got the language. But if, for example, it was the dreadful example, if it was two humans and one person was being chased and the other person was the chaser, they might be, their physiology is probably very, very, very similar. But because we're humans, we're mixing together these ingredients. The context here is what matters. You know, what is the situation? One person is feeling threatened, the other's seeing an opportunity perhaps to hunt them down for whatever nefarious purposes they have. So they may be experiencing a different conscious experience of the emotion, but the ingredient of the physiology is probably going to be pretty much the same, because they're both running as fast as they can, but for different purposes in a way. So they may then use different language to describe that conscious experience. So that's where I think if we start thinking about it that way, we realise that if we're using fight or flight, that may not be appropriate, because it implies fear. Maybe I like threat, challenge, opportunity. So I think, you know, once we start realising the importance of language in terms of our conscious experiences, I think it's a really good way to teach people about, we're pretty complex beings, us humans, and the words that we use to describe our experiences are a pretty fundamental part of the conscious experience that we happen in, and that's really in a moment by moment kind of thing as well. And so then that power and the kind of opportunity that comes from that is, you know, being able to teach that to other people, being able to teach them. I'm sure you do this using far more nuance, or what we would say teaching emotional granularity, teaching people to use words to describe the kind of the nuance of the emotional landscape that they have and that they can experience in response to a situation, and not just use happy versus sad versus scared, but all of the many, many kinds of words that we can use to describe a situation.
Which is that name it to tame it idea, that if we can give words to our experience, then we automatically take a little bit more control, because we can start to unpack a bit. And sometimes we can really surprise ourselves. You know, if we look at those emotion wheels, and I've shown people, there's a few of them, I can put one in the show notes for today's episode, but an emotion wheel that really does, you know, it starts with kind of what might be the basic language that we use to describe feelings like anger, fear, sadness, joy. You know, there's half a dozen or six or eight, depending on whose model you look at. And then as we kind of fan those out into more complex words that then say, okay, I'm feeling angry. Well, I'm actually feeling irritated. Am I feeling agitated? Am I feeling annoyed? Am I feeling resentful? You know, a lot of those things could at first blush look and feel the same, but feeling resentful and being able to identify and label that versus feeling irritated, could be quite different. And as soon as we've got those words for them, then we can start to say, well, why resentful? What is the resentment? You know, what's driving that?
Yeah.
Versus, you know, why the irritation and what's driving that? And then we can explore and unpack.
Yeah, for sure. And it gives you the opportunity to unpack what are the other ingredients that have led to this?
Yeah.
Which you don't, if you've just got anger, you don't get to experience the other. We don't get to unpack them in the same way. And there's so many great examples of using words to enable us to have new emotional experiences going ahead. And so I take a look at this as well, that being able to take words to describe emotions or feelings from other languages is a really kind of fun way to open your eyes up to the possibilities as well. So one of the great examples out there is this German word Schadenfreude, which was a word that wasn't really used. I don't know when it sort of started being used more commonly in the English language, but it's this idea that, you know, you kind of feel a little bit of pleasure with someone else's misfortune, even if perhaps there's someone that you quite like. You have a bit of a smirk with someone you don't like, perhaps, hurts themselves or has something terrible happen to them. Now, if our emotions are driven by lizards and are like kind of hardwired from, very, very early on in evolution, how on earth could we suddenly recognize a new emotion, when we're kind of borrowing it from a different language? And lots of people now are really familiar with that feeling that you might have of Schadenfreude once they're given a word to describe that. And we can go and start exploring lots and lots of different words used to describe very precise emotional experiences that are used in other languages apart from English. And that's really fun. People really enjoy that. And I think, once again, teaches people, well, every emotional response you have isn't some hardwired, lizardy emotion that's based on fight, flight, or fear. Actually, it's a far more kind of beautiful landscape that we kind of have to explore when we've got this sort of rich, almost thesaurus in front of us. And I assume, I'm not a psychologist, I don't work with patients, but that there must be a great opportunity and sense of agency and amount of healing almost that comes from that.
Yeah, I mean, talking therapy, really, which has been the mainstay of psychology for a hundred years in very many different varied forms over time, but it is still, you can't talk without language and you can't explore ideas without language and you can't explore experience without the language and talking about what's going on for someone and helping them to find the words and the concepts. Mm. So that level of understanding about what might be going on and then being able to explore using language, well, what is it exactly that's going on for me? What does that look like? And then the important part, which is, what am I going to do about it?
Yeah.
So understanding is one point, but then moving it into some form of action. How am I going to resolve this, come to terms with it, think about it differently, come to acceptance of it, whatever that may be. Sarah, do we know what happens in the brain when we're using language to describe a feeling?
Well, I think it's another one of the ingredients, really, in the conscious experience. So it's hard when we start thinking about what happens where in the brain, because in a way that's kind of almost like an old-fashioned way of thinking about a lot of brain functions, particularly those higher order functions that humans are capable of. Thinking about a word for a feeling, for example. Of course, there's parts of the brain which are devoted to processing vision and parts of the brain which are devoted to controlling the muscles of your arms or your legs or your hands and parts of the brain devoted to regulating heart rate. But when we start looking at, well, where in the brain does the word used to describe the feeling I'm having in this situation come from, we need to start talking about how does this emerge from what the brain does. And we start using language again, changing the way we talk about these things. We start now talking about what are the various networks which are activated and involved, and how does that conscious experience emerge from the processing of all of these different networks. And there's probably different parts of the thinking brain, like that kind of prefrontal cortical part of the brain, and also the language centers of the brain, which are in the temporal lobes, which are activated when we are learning those words, when you're having a discussion with someone about how to come up with these new words used to describe, versus, maybe 6 months down the track when you automatically use those words to describe a sensation. So there'll be vast regions of the brain involved in that processing. we'll have the parts of the brain like the insular cortex, which is involved with what are the sensations happening in my body. We'll have the language part of the brain. We might even have like the visual and auditory cortex, because you're kind of looking and hearing about the situation you're in. You might have parts of the brain involved with recall of old memories. We don't really kind of know where memories are stored in the brain, only that they must be stored somewhere because they are there. So there's probably a whole host of networks in which that experience is emerging from. And we talk about this a bit in neuroscience now. This experience emerges from the functioning of all of these networks rather than it being in a place. So it'll be the processing of, again, the parts of the brain involved with body, with the world around us, with our previous thoughts and memories and perhaps language centres.
It is quite a different way. And I'm sort of interested as I hear you speak, because again, you know, I operate in a world where a lot of people, probably less so the psychologists, but certainly, as you say, coaches, other people that I hear marketing speak, things like that, and talking about the brain and what happens in these different parts of the brain. And this probably takes us back to kind of earlier in our conversation about this being a nice, easy, we can sort of visualize a brain and have, and to be fair, I think probably even if I go back to thinking about how I was taught about developmental neuropsychology and neurophysiology, to be fair, 30 years ago when I started university, over 25 anyway, you know, you had your map of the brain and it pointed to all of these bits, you know, and this happens here and that happens there and the other happened. And so I'm wondering whether, you know, what fascinates me about science and the fact that we have to stay on top of all of the new stuff all the time, because it's always an ever-growing, shifting, changing, evolving. You know, no scientist would ever say, this is it, this is the definitive answer. It's always, this is what we know right now. So, you know, is it that stuff that perhaps is 25, 30 years old is starting to filter into more of the general consciousness now? People are kind of going, oh, that's cool, that's easy, that makes sense, I understand that. Nice little picture of the brain, point to all the bits. And then we can use that as a model, and yet the field has moved on into ways that are far more, you know, we're talking about those kind of emergent properties of complex systems, which is, you know, what's going on in these networks, which is quite a different way of thinking about it. And I'm guessing part of your goal with things like the Neuroscience Academy is to help people to move along with the times and be able to digest. Because digesting new science is hard. I mean, it's hard for those of us who are used to reading scientific papers.
It's hard for me. And that's why I try and use, what are people talking about? What words are they using? What are they interested in right now? What's kind of the moment? And let's see if we can get the neuroscience in this conversation accurate. Because we might as well, if we're going to be talking about the brain, or else we're just using words which are baseless. And I think when an idea is really well established and tested and we understand it, we know an awful lot about, you know, that map of the little person on the motor cortex, where each of, you know, we can kind of map the body out around the motor cortex. And that's a very well-established fact now. The sort of the basics of how the brain controls movement and how the body senses parts of the body and how the visual system works and how the auditory system works, that's pretty well established. And we've been able to look at that in great detail in animals. Obviously, there's a, you know, when we start getting down into the kind of the cellular molecular pathways and all the electrophysiology, it gets a little bit more complicated. But a lot of these ideas were very, very well established 20, 30, 40 years ago. And so they are very easy concepts to then explain to people. But when we're looking at these far more complex ideas, that the kind of cognitive neurosciences, you know, how do we weigh up decisions? How are memories formed and why do we recall them? What happens when we are dreaming? What is consciousness? What is my awareness of self? A lot of these are a whole lot more complex. We don't actually always know the answers to them. So our way of explaining them in a simple way, we simply can't explain them very simply or clearly yet. The problem is when there's a bit of a gap like that, and that's what I try and teach a lot of my students, is when we've got a gap, often that gets filled with a bit of a oversimplified or often inaccurate explanation. We don't know. So let's just kind of make something up which sounds right and we'll use that. And that's often where the problems come in. And what I try and teach people is, neuroscience might get us to a certain point. There's going to be a gap in our knowledge. We can acknowledge that gap. We can say we don't know. It's complicated. We're working on that, rather than filling it up with a little made-up story just to make ourselves feel better. I think 2020, I hope 2020 has shown people who are outside the scientific world how science is done. You know, we've almost seen science, the science of viruses and public health and vaccine development being live-streamed to us. It's the first insight lots of people have had into the scientific process and how it's not a series of facts necessarily, but as we gain more information and understanding, sometimes things change. Sometimes public health messages change based on new information that we've got, or, you know, we get in more data. We really have to almost make a turnabout based on that. And that doesn't mean what we were told earlier was fake or was incorrect or the scientists were lying. It just means that as the process develops, we need to kind of work with that. And so I think 2020, the live streaming of science for the first time for many people, it's a great way to educate people at how this is done. And the uncertainty we have now, perhaps about, you know, is the stage 3 trial of the Oxford vaccine. We really don't know where that's going to go at the moment. That was not something that we really had a concept of back in February. Back in February, we were still trying to understand, why is it really important to wash your hands all the time? You know, yeah. The messaging has changed as science has changed. Doesn't mean what we were told previously wasn't correct. We've moved. And that's, I think, what we're seeing in the neurosciences over the last sort of 20, 30, 40 years.
That's such an excellent point. I have had conversations, particularly at home, about how it is great to see science being out there at the forefront of public discourse, certainly in parts of the conversation. I mean, my daily listening is CoronaCast.
Oh, yeah, I love CoronaCast.
I need to hear the latest on what Tegan Taylor and Dr. Norman Swan have got for us in terms of where the vaccines are at, where's the practice, where's the public messaging, all of those pieces. So many more of us can say the word epidemiology now used to be able to. But, yeah, to actually think about the progression that we've made in terms of understanding some of these complex, and they are still complex. I mean, as much as I've been trained in science and work my brain hard to think about what's being said when I'm listening to information about stage 3 clinical trials, it's still difficult and it's still complex, and there's so many pieces to it, which again is fascinating if you're that way inclined. But it also is interesting, that human need for, I want to know the answer.
Yeah.
You know, I want to know what to do and why, and I want it to be black and white and straightforward, and I don't have to think about it, and this is what it is. And the tension that creates when it's out there in the world that's not how this stuff works. It's not how science, it's certainly not how things work in a global pandemic where nothing has been ever done, certainly not by anyone who's still alive to deal with these, and especially not in a world which is so global, you know, with travel, with messaging, with all of these bits and pieces. I mean, it's a fascinating experiment in so many ways, even if it's pretty uncomfortable to live with.
And I think a lot of that discomfort and confusion comes from what we would say is uncertainty. And we all had the sense of that this year, and that is because our brains like to know what is happening next. And not only when we're having these conscious experiences of an emotion, it's often based on our brain's best kind of guess of how should I be feeling, thinking and behaving in this instance. And your brain's constantly making a prediction based on previous experience and based on context. And for the first time ever, the entire planet suddenly, we don't know. Everything's uncertain. Some people are really cool with that uncertainty. Maybe some scientists are a little bit better with it because our profession is around not always knowing every answer, and, you know, we're constantly dealing with shades of grey and nuance and things kind of changing. But a lot of people have only ever lived with a great degree of certainty, and they don't like that. And that's that because our brains are constantly wanting to be able to predict what is happening next. When we can't, then what do we do? All we can rely on is, it's not a very nice place to be. It's a really uncomfortable place to be emotionally, is uncertainty. So we start looking for information to fill the gap. We start worrying. We start ruminating. It's 100% predictable that people would be developing mental health issues, to be developing anxiety, especially in the face of all of this uncertainty. And I suppose it's up to, you know, what do we do? Because the certainty isn't there. We can't rely on the outside world to make the predictions for us anymore. So what can we do instead to kind of help our brain, help our mind cope when we're in this type of situation?
Mm. And for a lot of psychologists, and I have had a fascinating conversation with Dr. Patricia Zurita Ona in my previous podcast episode around acceptance and the nature of acceptance, this idea from acceptance and commitment therapy, that when we start to make space for uncomfortable feelings like the not knowingness, and we start to, as much as we can, not even necessarily be okay with it, just acknowledge that it is, then we start to reduce some of those other associated uncomfortable feelings that come with it. And certainly, you know, that's the path that the psychologists are taking to try and help people through this particular experience. And like we said, you know, like anything, and this is part of the conversation that I had with her, that in psychology, that it's a relatively new paradigm in terms of thinking and dealing with these sorts of things. 30 years ago, maybe less, we would have looked at unpacking the thought processes and refuting, you know, using evidence to refute the uncomfortable thinking and all of that. Now, that is still important in ways, but it's not necessarily the be-all and end-all, because we now have a much greater understanding of the role of things like acceptance in mental health and well-being generally. And again, that's part of the process. And I think from a scientific point of view, it's about being curious and saying, well, what's going to come next? Mm. You know, we've got this cool stuff, and now we've got this cool stuff. There'll be other cool stuff on the horizon that we have yet to discover that's going to make a big difference. But that is a way of looking at the world and looking at information and knowledge that is perhaps different. Maybe it's part of the reason why we should all be taught the scientific method at school, but that's a little bandwagon.
Yeah. Well, I think they do try and teach it in science. I know they certainly do now, but I think there's perhaps it's not taught in a way that's relevant. Maybe science teachers right now should be saying, hey, let's watch the scientific method being live streamed to us during 2020. That would be really interesting to know whether, I mean, maybe some on the ball science teachers are doing that in high schools right now. Mm. I'm not sure. But it's, I think, a really good way of showing people that we don't always know, and then, you know, what are we going to kind of do instead? And like you say, the unknowingness, that's such a fantastic word, learning to kind of sit with that. And if you are really uncomfortable, what, you know, what kind of knowingness, what structures can you put in place in your day-to-day life around you, systems, processes, schedules, etc.? What certainty can you build so that you're not so uncomfortable? You can't rely on the outside world anymore. We can't rely on any of the holidays you had planned or the goals that you had set. The workplace isn't even there for many of us. What can you do and control? How can you build a bit of certainty in, even if it's just in that your small little family? And we were talking before about how you just have to start living a really small life. A friend of mine in New Zealand, they're a bit of behind Australia. The Kiwis thought that they were, you know, doing very well. Now they're kind of lagging behind. And they're now suddenly coming to terms with uncertainty. They thought they had it nailed. And now they're going, oh, things get cancelled. Oh, I can't make plans. Mm. It's like, well, 2020. You'll soon get used to the unknowingness, and you just sort of have to learn to sit with that discomfort and change how you set goals, you know, have different kinds of goals in place that are much smaller and closer in.
Mm. And I feel like those of us in Victoria, because you're in Sydney, but here in Victoria, having gone through this whole second wave and second lockdown, boy, I feel like we're perhaps even further down that path of, oh, I'm not even going to think about, because between the lockdowns, you know, a lot of the conversation certainly I was having with clients and with workplaces was the new normal and how we adapt to the new normal and what that's going to look like. And I think now for a lot of Victorians, we've almost got to the point where we've stopped even thinking about the new normal, because it's that extra level of uncertainty. It's having been through this twice now. Who knows? There's no point in even thinking about it anymore. No. Because who knows?
You don't even think about the weekend.
No.
You kind of get used to not looking ahead, and that's an incredibly important lesson. Hard, hard, hard one that everyone's having to learn this year. But I suppose if we wanted the opportunity and the future for the skills that we've learned now, it will be interesting to see how we cope. You know, the next unknowingness in our lives, it might happen on a more individual level perhaps, will we be better able to be equipped? Will we be more resilient? Will we be broken? It will be interesting to, you know, in a few years' time to look back and reflect on whether we've been able to use any of those skills that we've learned, even when we didn't want to.
Absolutely. And I'm an optimist, and I hope that most of us will actually emerge from this fitter, stronger, faster, more resilient as a result. It's not necessarily going to pan out that way for everyone across the population, sadly, but I think it's certainly an opportunity to learn. And this conversation has taught me a whole lot of things already. It's been fascinating. It always is talking to you and thinking now less about the brain as a set of structures, more as a complex set of, you know, these sort of emergent properties and feelings and emotions and all of those pieces, you know, coming from that, thinking less about what's happening in a bit of the brain that may or may not look reptilian, and into kind of more complex ways of thinking about it, which is, you know, far more interesting and does make a lot more sense. And then, as you say, and not looking at it as a threatening thing, looking at it as a positive and an optimistic, and a way of harnessing all of those signals that our brain and body gives us when we're under stress or when things don't feel necessarily comfortable, but being able to reframe that. So to align our two fields, being able to reframe that and say, well, you know, this is perhaps an opportunity rather than a threat. And that may well be the theme for the whole of 2020.
Yeah. And I think we probably should also stay humble and acknowledge that all of this may completely change in 10 years' time. This conversation will be null and void. But for now, I think hopefully it can give people a few, you know, thoughts that they can take away and perhaps use in a useful way.
Yeah, it's a marker of a point in time. Sarah, thank you so much for all of that. I'm going to pop, we had lots of things we spoke about today, so I will pop the links to books, TED Talks, papers, your blog post, everything else that we've mentioned in the show notes for today's episode. I'll also put a link to the Neuroscience Academy. I'm not sure where you're at with that.
We're launching tomorrow, but I'll be running it again next year, and I run a couple of versions of it. So I'm now running a, thanks to 2020 and changed plans of mine this year, I'm now running a 2-week version as well as the 12-week version, which has proven more successful than I thought. So there'll be a 2-week version of the Neuroscience Academy running early 2021 as well.
Fantastic. Well, that could be right up the alley of our listeners, a 2-week version of the Neuroscience Academy. And of course, people can find out all about it now and pop their names, I think, on a wait list perhaps for to know when it's all up and running again in 2021, whatever that may look like for all of us. So all those details will be there. Thank you again. Always lovely to have you on the show, and we will look forward to our next conversation.
Likewise.
Thank you so much for sharing that conversation with Dr. Sarah Mackay with me. I always love talking to Sarah. She has such a great way of bringing complex brain science to life. And if you're interested in finding out more about her and her work and her Neuroscience Academy and her education programs and her book, The Women's Brain Book, we have included all of the links you'll need in the show notes for this episode, or you can pop over to drsarahmackay.com. Her Brain Coach Boot Camp, that's not easy to say, is coming up. And it's a perfect opportunity to make sure that you are communicating current brain science if that is your thing. And we actually have some more fascinating brain science conversation coming up on the show for next episode, and I'll tell you about that shortly. But first, I have a small request. We have finally found a way to make leaving a podcast review easier. Finally. And I'd love it if you would do exactly that. I do read and very much appreciate every review, and it makes it so much easier for others to find and find out about the show and our wonderful guests and the wisdom and knowledge that they share when we have recent and plentiful reviews. That's just how these podcast platforms work. So when you get a moment right now, if it's practical, pop over to reviewthispodcast.com/potential. You will get a simple form that asks for a title, a brief review, and a star rating out of 5. You can then choose to share your review on Podchaser, Apple Podcasts, or Stitcher, and you're done. Quick, simple, much appreciated, and very helpful. We'll put the link in the show notes again, but it's an easy one to remember. It's reviewthispodcast.com/potential. Thank you. Okay, so what do we have coming up for our next episode? Well, we're talking about the brain again, but this time we are talking about something perhaps that you have may never have considered, certainly I had not considered, and that is our physical intelligence. What is it in our brain that stops us from walking into walls or off cliffs? How do you pick the right moment to cross a busy road or decide if you can drive through a storm? Or what helps you to discover a shortcut to a familiar route? What is going on in your brain when all of these things that I think we absolutely take for granted are happening? Because it's really terribly clever. They're all attributes of our physical intelligence. What my guest, neuroscientist, neurologist, and author Scott Grafton describes as a silent, ruthless intellect that we all possess. It is really thought-provoking stuff, and it is coming up in episode 87 of the show, hitting the airwaves on October 21. But until then, stay safe, go well, do everything in your power to fulfill your potential, even in the smallest way. Please leave a review of the show, and I will be back in your ears in a couple of weeks.